Hi, everyone. I'm just going to get right to it. There's a lot of money going into the energy transition right now. I'll give you a couple examples. There appears to be a sort of renaissance in climate tech venture capital this year with, according to PitchBook, nearly $15 billion in investment in H1 of 2021, nearly matching the previous full-year record. And I just saw BNF published a report on EV-related SPACs raising $10.2 billion in the past 2 months in public markets. But today, we're going to talk about even bigger stuff. Asset managers raising huge funds to invest in the energy transition. So things like wind and solar projects, other renewables like geothermal, EV charging networks, batteries, anything and everything zero carbon, as well as investments in the companies doing these projects and supplying the kit. Okay, so just to name a few of these funds, we're recording on July 29th. Yesterday, on the 28th, Brookfield announced a $7 billion fund that's on its way to $12.5 billion, a target. TPG, the day before, on the 27th, announced a $5.4 billion fund on its way to $7 billion target. And then back in April, we saw $8.4 billion from Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners and $4.8 billion from BlackRock. Okay, so in his latest piece for Bloomberg Opinion, Nat Bullard, chief content officer and friend of Switched On, talked about this frenzy in fundraising. We've got Nat on the show to tell us about it and give us a few frameworks for how to think about it. Along with his weekly column, Bloomberg users can catch Nat every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern, where he hosts Ask BNF, a weekly show where he gets into it with a BNF analyst on their recent work, and users can ask questions live. The next Ask BNF is on August 4th, where he'll talk with BNF analysts Vicky Cumming and Maya Godemer about the asset owner's path to net zero emissions. Register on BNF.com or SMNR Go on the Bloomberg terminal. As always, BNF does not provide investment or strategy advice, and you can hear the full disclaimer at the end of the show. I'm Mark Taylor, and you're listening to Switched On, the BNF podcast. Nat, welcome.
Mark, thanks for having me. It's nice to be back.
It's always great having you on the show. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, so we kind of decided to do this one really quick. We just started talking about it this morning because there's so much going on in this corner of the market. Can you put it in your own words kind of what's going on in the market and kind of describe why you decided to write about it this week?
So we're recording on Thursday, the 29th of July. And on Tuesday, the 27th of July, we got notice that two big alternative asset managers, TPG and Brookfield, have closed between them just under $12.5 billion worth of climate or climate transition funds. So big private equity funds designed to be deployed broadly around the theme of climate. Now, for reference, those are very, very big funds, even within the normal realm of like an energy or infrastructure fund. They're not even the only multi-billion dollar funds that have been closed this month. I think I looked back and found three or four others, and I found a number that are announced intentions to be that size. Those funds themselves aren't even fully closed. They're a $5.4 and $7 billion funds, respectively, that could go up to $7 and $12.5 billion. So we're talking about potentially just under $20 billion of funds that have come in. And it's just an extraordinary moment, certainly in general, but also, I think, given the history, rather fraught history in the last decade of fundraising, either at the early stage or later stages for anything climate related, it just sort of caught our eye, shall we say. Not just mine, but pretty much everybody we work with, everybody in my larger professional network. So I figured, let's put a little more sunlight on this and talk about it a bit more.
It was so, you know, I don't want to use the word shocking, but yeah, it, you know, caught our eye such this week that it kind of caught us off guard. We even stopped tracking these types of fundraises a few years ago because nothing was going on. Like, it just wasn't really happening.
We had to go through that sad process of what we call deprecation.
Yeah.
taking a product that was sort of a fallow field within the larger pasture of things that we cover in research and say, this is probably something that we don't need to devote a lot of time to because there's just not a lot of activity and a lot of inbound interest. And here we are.
And what's the reverse? Yeah. Resurrection? I don't know.
Right. And now we have something, though there's one thing to say about that, which is that this also shows that it was no longer probably running through such specialized specialty financial channels too. It was no longer potential limited partners coming through a specialty funnel, if you will, to then go back out into a specialty market. What it was instead is the world's collective pool of limited partners going to a pretty well-established funnel of the world's biggest alternative asset investors. And that's that. In many ways, it follows a pattern that we don't really need to track because it is already very well tracked in general within the world of finance and capital raising. It's just that this happens to be taking place not for a real estate fund, not for an infrastructure fund in general, but for specific climate transition.
Let me give you one more gee whiz thought on that. Is 10 years ago when we were tracking this more closely and all this stuff, I talked to a friend of mine who worked at a private equity, right? And I was like, hey, you guys should look at renewables. It's getting pretty cool. And the answer, you know, I talked to him multiple times about this and it was always, it's not big enough. You know, the funds that would be raised that we would do, they don't match the numbers that we are typically used to looking at. Well, this PE shop, they are on the list that you mentioned of funds that have announced, you know, and I don't even think they're going to be, you know, in the top 10 of size, you know? So like, things have changed.
Things have certainly changed. And we can actually track that change, weirdly, at about the same time that you had prospective fundraisers sort of saying that nothing was big enough for us to invest in. We saw the assets being created that later on they could invest in. In fact, right about that same time is when we saw the first multi-billion dollar club deals for offshore wind in Europe, which actually were a way of kind of kickstarting things into a scale of capital that finally mattered. I remember the first time I ever talked to sovereign funds, and this was even earlier than the time that you're describing. So let's say 2009, 2010. Their problem was being like, yeah, actually, you know, the returns profiles are okay for what we like. The speed with which we can move is also doable, all that kind of stuff. Is anything 10 times bigger? Like, our ticket size is 10 times bigger because that's the weight that we move in. Like, our due diligence process and our timelines don't really reward doing things this small. Like, we're going to do the same amount of diligence if we're acting in a $500 million chunk or in a $50 million chunk.
So speaking of deploying that capital, right? So we've talked a bit about how much it is or how much is going into this stuff, but like, they're all being described as, quote, transition funds, basically. Now, what are they going to be spending that money on?
Well, that's a little bit unclear. I have to say that given the general trajectory for a fund of that size, it almost certainly would be tilted towards asset investment. Like, it has to probably flow into assets and infrastructure at that size. You do see some general purpose venture funds that are in the multiple billions, but they would be probably doing later stage software investment that might still happen, you know, $50 million ticket sizes per institution in the fundraise at a time. But they're probably not going into like angel round funding, friends and family rounds for things that have spun out of universities. They're almost certainly going to be going at that price for assets. But the caveat to that is that some of the funds have said that they are interested in looking relatively early on, like at a sort of an early stage growth. So providing the first walk around money for a big developer could be one. We definitely saw that happen back in the day. The question, and we can talk about this a little bit later if it's interesting, is what does that imply for pricing of assets and pricing of companies when you have all that capital chasing in something that's inherently smaller, perhaps, than the pool of available capital within a fund?
Just to be clear, for assets, you mean like projects, like physical stuff?
Things, yes. You may not be buying them at the stage of commissioning yet, but you're buying into a pool of physical assets, as opposed to an acquisition that is primarily concerned with intellectual property, broadly speaking, right? It's going towards property, plant, and equipment, if you want, rather than intellectual property.
Right. Okay. One thing that I thought was really interesting looking at some of these announcements was, I think it was the BlackRock announcement, where they said that, you know, traditionally our previous two funds in this space have been solely on operational assets, but now we're going into construction assets and even just announced stuff, announced projects. So they're going, you know, further afield, I guess you could say. I thought that was pretty telling of where things are going.
It's a sign, I think, of a sort of collective mass de-risking, if you will. If an asset manager at that size is willing to start to go earlier and earlier in the development stage, that implies greater confidence writ large across the sector and perhaps in the particular operators as well that they are investing in. So that's another sign of success. If you're dealing with developers whom you've seen prove success in the past, go from dirt, you know, from basically being a dirt farmer and dealing with permission and rights of way all the way towards commissioned assets. And you realize that you can invest along that continuum, if you will, on an asset basis, then maybe you are willing to do that. Also, they may find that pricing is more advantageous. Certainly, your spreads are going to compress the closer you get towards construction because the risks are in turn lower, right? I mean, this is kind of pretty familiar credit stuff. Maybe the case is that you're finding a risk-reward tolerance that is shifting towards the early stage because you want more reward and you're either more willing to take on the risk or you think that the risk itself is perhaps mispriced. Right, so you're willing to go earlier into development stage because you see that that's where the value can be captured.
You know, all of these funds are raised from investors. Who are the parties involved putting money into these funds?
So the archetypal participants in any kind of infrastructural fundraising like this, and generally most of the institutions funding what happened this week, are what we broadly call institutions. And institutions in this case are endowments from a university. They are sovereign funds. They are pensions, retirement funds, things of that sort. And they're basically saying, well, we have $200 billion of assets under management. Let's devote, you know, 0.2% of it to this fund this year and maybe 1% of it overall in any given year to this kind of asset class. So that's pretty typical. The Ontario Teachers Pension Plan or the similar institutions in the state of California might be doing something like that. What's intriguing this time around is that you find other institutions that we don't qualify as an institutional investor. And that would be things such as a Nike, a Honeywell, a corporation acting as a limited partner, which is intriguing. That doesn't often happen. You see companies of all sorts these days setting up their own venture wings. So they are, sometimes they'll set up a completely separate process wherein they have hived off and ring-fenced a general partner that interacts with the rest of the company as a limited partner to the general partner. Or they might be a limited partner in somebody else's fund as a sort of broader blanket or broader umbrella of corporate venture capital. This is something very different. This is like corporate limited partnership in mostly assets-based businesses. And I think we need to watch very closely to see what the intentionality is there over time. Part of it, I mean, it could be purely financial. I mean, it could be that the companies that are raising the funds are simply giving an expectation of returns that looks very, very favorable and very, very healthy. And as a treasurer, chief investment officer, chief financial officer of any big company, it simply pencils out. Ideally, that's the case anyways. There's some component of that. You're not taking a flyer on it completely. But the rest is like, what's the additional gain? Is it, you know, is it within the broader mandate of ESG of an institution? Is it part of its sustainability strategy? Is it part of its talent identification? It's thinking about its own investing. I mean, that has often been, I think, one of the complex dual mandates or triple mandates within venture capital, that companies want to make money, identify deals and identify partners at the same time, all equally well, which is, I think, difficult. One of them, I feel like, has to be sublimated to the others, or one rather has to be the first among the equals. The chief goal, which personally I would always say should probably, given the nature of investing as a limited partner, be money. but that's not necessarily the way that everybody sees it. In fact, most of the times that I hear a corporate fund being described, it's more along the lines of we're looking to achieve all of these goals at once. So in this case, it's even more derivative, I think, because, you know, by being a limited partner in a mostly asset and infrastructure related fund, you're not sort of getting a preview necessarily on a new technology or new market structure, things like that.
I think you would on suppliers, right?
Potentially.
Suppliers and potential developers. Because some of these funds were saying, you know, hey, we're going to be using this money for projects like assets and what they were calling it, growth equity, right? So identifying the, what you called walking around money for a developer. And so if I'm like a big corporate, you know, I need a developer to acquire later, maybe this is a good chance to get them up to speed.
Potentially so. And so I would actually like to see how this plays out and how it's proven out. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see two things. One, how the corporations themselves describe the initiative here, like the prime mover of their decision making. And two, what they actually do over time. And that may be a bit of a data challenge over time, because we don't necessarily see any of these things, right? They're unlimited partners within a general partnership structure that is itself a private entity. And then we may not find out a lot, but I think we should interrogate this as much as possible, because it's fascinating to see. And I think it's very important to determine where future pools of capital might go, like how companies themselves might disrupt this otherwise quite traditional flow of capital through the funnel, if you will.
But let's step back a little bit. Why now? So what is going on right now? What is the world telling us to say that these funds should be raised at this moment?
One element is probably policy signal, right? Betting along the vector that eventually every major jurisdiction in the world will have some sort of net zero target. And that's, when I say major jurisdiction, I'm thinking about that on the kind of molecular carbon dioxide basis.
Okay.
Every major emitter, if you will have some mandate to, insofar as possible, decarbonize as much as possible. I think that's one. Two, I feel like there's probably a general awareness, in a very good way, of the competitive or out-competing economics these days of doing cleaner types of investment on the asset side, and maybe even further upstream of that, you know, investing in technology companies, that there's potential there.
So you're saying just the economics just make sense, and that's being recognized?
Yes, that's being recognized. It's being and it's also been priced. And I think on the flip side of that is that the tail risk / stranded asset risks associated with other types of investing may become more apparent, right? So that risk premium is probably going up for some other types of investing on the other side of the carbon ledger, if you will. Now, that doesn't mean that those investments don't happen. They just maybe become more specialized. They become the domain of more specialized, not so much general funds.
We go back to 2010 a lot, I guess. But 2010, we kept seeing the boutique banks doing these types of deals, right? And maybe it's not, we're not talking banks, but maybe it flips, right? So maybe it's now the boutiques doing the coal plant.
Yes, I would say like and actually that is absolutely the case already. If you want to do a coal plant investment in Europe and North America, you are almost certainly doing it with, at the highest level, maybe a special situations group within an established bank. Though honestly, I doubt it. It's much more likely that you're dealing with a specialty private equity fund that looks at that type of asset, that type of market, and also looks at specific instruments within that. They might be like, great, we'll take you to our energy distressed debt fund, you know, as opposed to our $7.5 billion soft close or $7 billion soft close on our climate transition fund. I think there's just a zeitgeisty element. Not to sound too hand-wavy about it, but there is, you know, a sense that there is a more categorical imperative to decarbonize in more places and in more ways. And I think a sense, too, that I'm interested to see how this reflects within climate transition over time, that it is about more than the electron, that it starts to go into things that are about chemistry and not just about physics, so to speak, you know, that start to get into the difficult to decarbonize spaces that we know very well will take tens of trillions of dollars, but also maybe the sorts of tens of trillions of dollars that align with the sorts of things that people already invest tens of trillions of dollars into. Pipelines, plants for transforming molecules, supply networks, things of that sort that better align with the expectation of investing, you know, $1 billion at a time.
Do you think this is the start, or do you think this is like, you know, a culmination or something like that? Like, what should we expect going forward?
It's a good question. I expect it to be sort of still within a continuum. I don't know when we'll see a high watermark on it. We will probably look at it and be like, okay, that's it. This $17 billion fund that was closed in 6 weeks, specifically around, I don't know, green hydrogen production in one market, is probably the kind of thing about that seems kind of high watermarky to me. But I don't know that we're anywhere close to that yet. So I would still say that it's a continuum. There's still an awful lot of institutional money waiting to go. And this is a neutral statement, but there does tend to be a lot of trend following going along. Like these institutions, I would say, that are doing these fundraisers are really, really apex institutions within alternative with an alternative investment. And I think that implies if they're so oversubscribed, if they have so much interest from so many different parties, it implies a much greater total addressable market to shake out over time and perhaps come down a little bit in fund size, specialize a little bit more. I think this would be entirely healthy if that was the case, right? I mean, I think it's possible we get some larger funds beyond this point. It's also possible we get a thousand flowers blooming of more specialized funds with similar enthusiasm.
So like the whoever Canadian Wind Fund.
Yeah, I'm raising the mid-market green hydrogen fund for the Benelux. That actually should not sound too specific in that sense, given the scale of what might be happening, right? Where things come in with a tight targeting based on appetite, the limited partners, specific expertise in technology, all that kind of stuff.
If you'll indulge me, if I can give my slight take for a second. NEO, the New Energy Outlook that just came out last week from BNEF, right? We put investment in there required to achieve net zero or between our different scenarios out to 2050 at like 92 to 173 trillion in the next 30 years. And so I penciled that out and we put capacity, you know, for wind and solar only, like not even talk about hydrogen and things like that, but wind and solar only at 18% now of capacity and what, 70% in 2050, right? And so if you just use average project sizes, that gives you 366,000 new projects that have to be built in the next 30 years. And so to me, yeah, this might be a culmination or a high watermark for this type of fund, but like there's still a drop in the bucket in comparison to what kind of could be expected to be built in time.
The headroom within the markets in order to reach a net zero energy system is so huge that there's no chance on a pure capital basis of anybody crowding anybody else out.
Exactly. That's the point I'm trying to make. Yeah, exactly. Totally.
Yeah. None of these funds are saying like, well, that's it. I've stitched up the opportunity and the rest yeah. of them can go get stuffed. Like that's not possible. there's a different thing to be said about what it means for valuations, what it means for sort of distribution of interest in investment types. But that's perhaps a different conversation.
Before we go to break though, let's do one last one on that. Like if everybody wins, who loses? Like if it seems like there's room for everyone, you know, who are the winners and losers here?
I don't necessarily think of it in winners and losers, but I can think of it in terms of vector. And that is that you may have a very stiff competition that pushes valuations up for certain asset types. That could make it challenging, especially in the early stage.
Like wind leases, offshore wind leases in the US, right?
But also on the company level, like if you know, where in these institutions are going to participate in, say, a Series B or C round, which I think some of them probably will. They're going to be competing with each other and with general venture funds along the way that have, in many cases, a history of bidding extremely aggressively and being very, very founder friendly. So SoftBank, of course, is well known for this sort of behavior. So is Tiger Global. And when you could have a sort of miniaturized version of that within the funds that we've described right now. And you could also have external non-specialty funds at the Series B and C level doing that same competition. And it could be a pretty aggressive bidding up. Could be very founder friendly. It could be challenging for some of the long-term, really expert investors in early stage climate tech investing, of which there are now a number. There are plenty of veterans that are around and are raising new funds, and it could make it very challenging in that element. I feel like I find it unlikely that a very large alternative investment manager is going to be doing seed round funding. It's just simply not worth the trouble. And it's not, you're not really set up to diligence things like that. But you might find it competing in a B round or a C round against, you know, a fund that has been raised specifically for climate tech 2 or 3 years ago and is doing its own follow-on investing with things that it has sort of carefully nurtured from seed on up. So that will be interesting to see. There is also the worry, as always, I think, that there are certain asset classes that still prove to be too challenging to invest in for any number of reasons. Like, would any of this funding end up devoted to newer nuclear power technologies? I don't know. Like, ticket size wise, they should be perfectly suited, but are they within the risk profile?
Right. Or direct air capture or something like that. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think there's always that. And then there's always things that might have a sort of regulatory brittleness to them, be very binary, if you will, which is, I would love to invest in that hydrogen network, but only if, you know, only if something is backstopping it. And what is that thing? You don't need to backstop doing rooftop PV almost anywhere right now, but you do probably need to do it to build a green hydrogen network. Without that happening, it may be very difficult. It could be a virtuous cycle. The backstopping institution, whatever that might be, is willing to do it, and therefore capital flows. Or it could be a vicious cycle, in which case neither one commits because neither one is committed.
Thanks, Nat. When we come back, we're going to get a little bit more into Nat's recent piece talking about networks in all of this. Stay with us. So this week we had CEO of AES, Andrés Gluski, on the show. He talked about how he got his start in telecoms in the 90s and how the changes he's seeing in the power sector now remind him a ton of telecoms then. So that reminded me of your piece today, how you saying these changes relate a lot to networks. Can you kind of describe the concept you're setting out there?
I'm often looking to analogize what's happening in our sector to other sectors. And I think that there's something both very beguiling, but also potentially a bit dangerous in saying everything is networked now. So I've been hesitating for a very long time to kind of work that angle. If for no other reason, then duh. Like, they have network in their name, like an electricity network, a vehicle charging network. It runs the risk of being not terribly insightful. But I was doing a little bit of reading, and I came across one of Chris Dixon's essays. Chris Dixon is now at Andreessen Horowitz, and he has this brief but really fantastic essay called Come for the Tool, Stay for the Network. And he talks about how, in the case of his example was Instagram, something that began as a pure tool, add a filter to your photo, became something that could create a network. It attracted people for its utility. It becomes sticky because it has an expanded utility. And then it becomes essentially embedded because other people are using it and you can share within it. You create value for users, you create value for investors in so doing. And so I thought, this is actually an interesting, potentially fruitful hook to use for looking at what might be coming next in the broad bucket of climate tech investment. Is that it's too easy to just say everything's a network. We have to sort of think about how they start. And so I took that logic from Dixon's essay, and I wanted to look at it across the world of climate tech. I probably could have picked dozens of examples. And in fact, I put out an open outcry in the bottom of my column. Send me a note with things that you can think of as an example of tool becoming network. So send them to me if you have them, and I will happily read them. And I came up with three. Which was, the first one was looking at energy storage. So a battery is a tool. Battery in my phone is a tool. I use that to charge up my thing, right? It provides power. I charge it up. It provides power. That's a tool. If you have 100,000 of them connected together, be it at the home scale, at a grid scale, whatever, that's a network. They begin to interact with each other. There's differential values distributed over time and space that therefore allow people to arbitrage, to trade, to transact. So that's a perfect example, I think, of where like a tool that I have becomes a network. We all have them and we put them together. And it's not just that they're connected, it's that there's greater value to be derived from them too. I think that that's actually the most important part. That's the part that I want to make sure is always emphasized when everybody says, well, like, this reminds me of telecoms, or there's a network that's being created. Is it needs to be also a creation of value, not just of connection.
It reminds me of one of the most fascinating essays I've ever read, actually. Lewis Thomas wrote an essay a long time ago. He was a biologist, physician, about ants and how an individual ant is a neuron, but oversimplifying, many ants becomes a brain that can build structures, can transport goods, can do all kinds of different things. They become a network.
And isolated on its own, that ant is, it's strong, but not particularly capable.
He said aimless.
Aimless is a very nice way of saying it. Right. Not directed. I mean, in the case of ants, they require a pheromonic connection. Like, they don't actually do anything without a connection to each other. They don't really act. Even if they are out, foraging, scouting, they're only doing so in connection to a larger group of entities that's connected behind them. Okay. So from entomology
there you go.
To, yeah. to what I will broadly call climate intelligence. That's everything from measuring deforestation and afforestation to emissions to, carbon footprinting different objects to what I use as my more specific example, carbon accounting and accounting up for and around climate risk. And I said that these things, the reason I think about these in particular as being networked in value is that if we continue to accumulate individual tools, we will have dozens of standards for doing these things, which means we don't have standards, right? We have two ways of doing accounting in this in the world right now. Very roughly speaking, GAAP and non-GAAP accounting. So we sort of probably want to, there will be a taxis towards having only a few standards for all of these things over time. And in so doing, two things are working at the same time. First is that they are attracting, as they become more powerful, they attract more people to them, more entities to them, which makes them more powerful. And they consolidate around a shared set of standards that makes them lower in cost and more useful and attracts in turn more things, more entities towards using them. So I was thinking about it that this is a place where the tool, measuring your emissions, gains intense value from becoming part of a network when everybody's doing it the same way. There's a huge amount of shared learning and a great deal of shared expertise. And this was actually something that one investor wanted to emphasize to me in writing today to say that, you know, the fourth tool that becomes a network is people ourselves, you know, that we individually are a tool for climate tech and collectively we are an instrument for a network for changing the climate. So that I think is actually very well spotted to go along with that same notion. And then the third one I said was 24/7 renewable power, though we could probably expand that to 24/7 zero carbon power, sort of broaden the brush a little bit. And the reason I said that is that, like, okay, the classic instrument for reducing my emissions as a corporation, my electricity emissions at least, is I sign a power purchase agreement with a wind or a solar farm. That has reduced my emissions commensurate to X percent of demand for something. Usually I'm offsetting the emissions from this data center by acquiring wind. That's great. But we've seen Google and we've seen some other institutions as well go about a process of essentially saying, I actually want to meet all of my demand 24/7 by doing that. And that necessarily requires looking generally beyond one particular region for sourcing electricity, one particular technology, one particular market approach, all that sort of thing. And it, again, necessitates interconnection and requires it in the process. So, you know, I closed it off by saying a wind power purchase agreement is a tool and zero carbon 24/7 power is a network. So that's a case, again, like where they have an accretive value of things coming towards them and coming into them that creates value for everybody involved as well. And that ideally has virtuous cycles, I suppose, within it. Things that get cheaper and better, shared learnings, shared expertise, shared knowledge.
And so as more of these funds that we, you know, open the show with get raised and get deployed, we'll have more of these networks of 24/7 zero carbon power.
Ideally, yes. And what I would hope is that those funds, when they're deploying capital, are asking questions about what additional value beyond the internal rate of return they're going to generate over time. And where that might have knock-ons for other stuff within their portfolio, right? And where it might be creating durable competitive advantages over time for the companies that are making those decisions, not just for the assets, but for the companies that are making those decisions as well.
Nat, always a pleasure having you on.
Thanks, Mark. It's a treat. Let's do it more often.
Definitely.
Well, you're probably sick of me by this point, but no, any time I'm happy to hop on. And thank you for reading. Thanks for grabbing me on short notice. I like doing stuff like this. It's good for everybody.
And just for everybody, where can they find you on Twitter?
Nat Bullard. It's pretty easy. NatBullard. In the spirit of deprecation, I have long since deprecated my very industry-specific in-joke of a Twitter handle, unlike somebody I know.
Oh, well, I was going to talk about
that. New Gold Rush.
I was embarrassed about the New Gold Rush for a long time because I put it up there like in 2010 because, you know, I thought like, oh, this is happening. Right. You know, renewables is happening. But guess what? Like, now it actually kind of makes sense. I don't know.
You weren't wrong, Mark. Just early.
There you go. On that note, thanks a lot, Nat.
Thanks, Mark. Take care.
This week's show was produced by Ava Gonzalez-Isla and edited by Rex Warner of Greystoke Media.
Bloomberg NEF is a service provided by Bloomberg Finance LP and its affiliates. This recording does not constitute, nor should it be construed as, investment advice, investment recommendations, or a recommendation as to an investment or other strategy. Bloomberg NEF should not be considered as information sufficient upon which to base an investment decision. Neither Bloomberg Finance LP nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed.